Oh, how sweet.
Once again, to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rat Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires we call the interwebs is Joe Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
Day 19 without Twinkies. It's beginning to fit. Zombie apocalypse. Black Friday. Twinkies. Larry Hagman dying. It's all connected. I just haven't found the linchpin. The one thing that connects them all. But I will.
Marvel now?
As God is my witness, I'll never bow cream filled cupcake free again.
So you're taking the death of Hostess rather hard.
Let's just say I had tremendous joy in finding the last ding-dong and ho-hos in this godforsaken town. Yes, I can now safely say I will die with a ding-dong in my hand.
We've all been saying that. Hey, it's the crickets. By the way, I was reminded by one of the listeners on the Twitter machine that we did get a name for the crickets that we just never used. The Jiminy Sickers.
Well, there's a reason why we didn't use them.
Hey, he was nice enough to remind me, and all I have to say is when you get older, the memory just goes, doesn't it?
What did you say?
So we just had the big holiday of Thanksgiving, which is the American holiday of eat a lot of food, and then go out the next day
Wednesday,
and buy a bunch of worthless crap.
Wednesday, I went to the Little Caesars in Liberal. It had just opened up, so everybody's all excited. It's really kind of sad because you see there's virtually no traffic at the two Pizza Huts in town. And you see the little person standing outside with the sign that says, "We got $5.99 pizzas too," but nobody cares. So I basically stopped and got a pizza, ate half of it Wednesday, ate the other half Thursday, and then also had a donut. So, which serendipitously was the same thing Bo Smith said he ate on the day after Thanksgiving. So,
well, there you go.
As for the day after, I just stayed in. There's one Walmart in town, and I didn't want to brave the crowds. Plus, there was nothing there that I really cared to have anyways. There was nothing there that was so spectacularly cheap that I had to rush in. Although it would have been good practice for the zombie apocalypse. Walmart. Is that part of the formula?
No.
I'll have to investigate.
Don't go to Walmart if there's a zombie apocalypse, because remember in the original Dawn of the Dead, they said that the zombies all went to the mall because it was a place that was important to them. The zombies will be going to Walmart.
No, I think they'll, judging by the amount of people at Little Caesars, they'll probably be there.
Now, Thanksgiving at the group home, I worked the night before, did a 12-hour shift. And I made their Thanksgiving dinner so that the turkey would be in the oven at 5 a.m. So, yeah, let the vegetarian make a turkey. I actually brined the turkey. I soaked the turkey in a brine that I had read up on from Alton Brown. And then the next day I took the turkey and it smelled really good. It smelled of allspice and ginger and Then I stuffed the cavity full of onions and apples and cinnamon sticks and rubbed it with oil that I'd soaked sage and rosemary in and put it in the oven. And last I heard was, oh, my God, this turkey smells so good. But I left at 9, came home, went to bed, because that's what you do after you do an overnight shift. Woke up, had some leftover French toast, and then went to the gym. And believe it or not, there were a couple people at the gym on Thanksgiving night.
I can believe that.
Yeah.
There was like one restaurant left open in town. It was a little mom and pop place that was just packed, you know, and I just,
yeah.
I was ready though. I had gone out, like I said, we stopped at Little Caesars. I'd gone to, like it's a Walmart, the only place to shop in this town. Picked up enough supplies to last me. And luckily enough, I did stop at a gas station yesterday, pick up Powerball, and they had one pack of Ho-Ho's and Ding Dongs. Not quite the Twinkies I'm looking for, but they will do in a quick substitution.
I was amazed at the local gas station here. The only thing they're out of are Twinkies. They still got all the Dolly Madison stuff.
Yeah,
they got the
Ho-Ho's,
they got the Ding Dongs, they got the
Susie Q's are around if you find them.
No, they didn't have any Susie Q's, but those are evil anyway. Cupcakes.
Yeah,
they had the cupcakes, regular cupcakes, and the orange cupcakes.
Oh, I could use regular cupcakes. And of course, they still got those powdered donuts that they leave on the shelf for 3 years. And of course, my favorite, the bag of wax chocolate donuts. You gotta have
yes.
a bag of those before you go on a road trip. It's just mandatory.
And if you have the powdered donuts, everybody thinks you're a cocaine user.
Well, it's like that one time on the way back from Chicago when I think we were driving, and I think in the car was myself, my partner Pat, Brian from the MCBA, and our good buddy Butch. And Pat was driving his normal 90 miles an hour, and we came up and over. He always said, Pat, pull over. He goes, why? Because the cop in the middle of the meridian is telling you to. And we're only about probably 200 feet from where the cop is. Takes the cop about 20 minutes to get out of the meridian and across the road because traffic is so heavy. Meanwhile, we're talking to Pat. You know, me and Butch are in the back seat, and it's like, hey, Pat, you didn't tell the cop we're done wrestling, done fixed, you know. It done fixed. Yep. And Butch is putting on his hockey mask that he wore, you know. And meanwhile, I've got powdered donuts, and I'm like rubbing them across my face. Ask the officer what nonchalant means. Oh. And Pat's like, nah, guys, just calm down. No, say nothing. And, you know, when the cop came, we behaved ourselves. And he's like, sir, do you know how fast you're going? So Pat lies. I think I was going 78. Sir, you were going 88. Oh, I'm sorry. I must have the cruise control. Pat's pulling out every trick in the book. It ain't happening. So he's not
30 enough.
Yeah, he gets himself a ticket. We pull out and we're on our way back. And then Brian, who's sitting shotgun, says the only thing he said the entire time, hey, Pat, bet this thing can't do 95.
You know what the beautiful thing about that story is? I've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
There was a videotape of most of these shenanigans, as well as the High Rob story and some other stuff.
Hi, Rob.
And we watched that tape up at the shop, of course, laughing ourselves sick. Gruber kept, turn it off! I don't want to see
this.
That's
funny. The sad thing is whoever got the tape never went around to share it.
Yeah, so it vanished.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Butch's or if it was Jess or who had it. Because we wanted to make copies.
Bring up stuff and get us hooked on things, that bastard.
Yeah, he was the first one to bring up SpongeBob. He brought a SpongeBob before it hit. Of course, the owners of the Hot Comics, they were hip on Ren and Stimpy. He brought up South Park when it was just six episodes before it went ballistic.
That's what I was going to talk about. He brought up South Park when it was just the six episodes.
Yep.
And none of us had seen it before.
So, you know, that's why I'm thinking he didn't have the copy of the tape. My guess is that Jess has it because there's also a video of him running around and they ran into Jim Lee and they were asking him all sorts of goofy questions. And then when Jim asked, like, oh, what comic store are you from? And they all got, oh, wow, we don't want to say a case in person. I'm sitting there thinking, from what I know of Jim Lee, he's not trying to pin something on him. He's just like, oh, you guys are with the comic store. Cool. Let's talk comic shop business, you know, because this is like early Image years, you know. But I digress.
But he brought up the South Park episodes, the first six. And it was in the smaller shop. And I remember you and I just were like, this is the greatest thing ever. The Starvin' Marvin episode, I don't know if I had laughed that hard in years before we saw it.
Okay, it's my pot pie.
So Butch would bring this stuff up, and we would be ahead of the curve, because Butch was kind of ahead of the curve on this stuff. And we would use it to order things. I remember you had all this South Park stuff in the shop before, basically as soon as they started marketing, you filled the shelves and you were like the only place around that had it.
Yeah. And some of the stuff, like when SpongeBob hit, he brought SpongeBob up. He's like, dude, you got to check this out. This is the funniest thing. SpongeBob SquarePants. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? And he was before anybody even knew it, you know, before it became the mega hit it is now. He always was good at bringing stuff up. There was this one on the USA Networks called Itsy Bitsy Spider. And the most notable thing about it was that Matt Frewer, you know, who most of us remember as Max Headroom, and he was doing the voice of the guy trying to stomp out the spider. And there were fun things in there. They'd put like live bits of Star Trek Next Generation in it. And it was just totally, it only lasted a season though, unfortunately. So did the Bad Pink Panther that Furrier did the voice of. And I don't fault for that. Whoever came up with it, Pink Panther, Tom and Jerry, there's certain people do not need to talk.
So what I wanted to ask about, seeing as how we just went through Black Friday, or as I like to call it, African American Friday.
Yeah, can we use that term?
We can use African American Friday.
Okay, I feel better now.
My Tales from the Shop question is, did you ever get burned on thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be unbelievably hot, load up on stuff, just to have it sit on the shelf till you blew it out for, like, here, give me a dollar and you can have it all, other than Pogs?
No, we did okay on Pogs. By the time we started getting out of them, it was I mean, we saw it coming. About the only thing we had left over, I had a box of sealed DC Comics Pogs, which Nick bought, the owner. Well, then he was just a friend, but now he's co-owner of the source. And he bought them just because he's thinking, yeah, they're DC products. Sooner or later, somebody's going to pull them out, and they're going to be valuable because it was a licensed product. And I've seen someone on eBay think they're going to get $75 a box for them. I was happy just to get my cost out of them, and it was sealed.
Pogs are coming back.
Yeah. I think Gruber bought a sealed box of Jurassic Park Pogs, which he has since brought to one of his, you know, many going out of business sales. I really can't think of, there's one comic in particular, Brotherhood from Marvel.
Oh yeah,
that written I remember X. Heavy on, and just being caught with them. And the problem, what happened with that was there was a big lawsuit that I didn't get part of. And I think I've talked about it in past podcasts, but Brian Hibbs, one of the curmudgeons of comics, basically called the task Marvel because they were violating their own terms. They shipped the book late. They changed the content on it. By the time the book shipped, nobody cared about it. And retailers were supposed to get a coupon worth credit towards other product. And this was the time when I went, sold the comic shop, and it was supposed to come to me, but it never did. And I know one of the other hot comics got a, I think Kristen's shop, she got her certificate. And I told her if I ever got mine, this was, I think they started shipping. I mean, I sold the store 2001.
One.
And I opened Crazy at 2004, and that's when the coupon shipped. But when I tried to find out, you know, I tried to say, hey, I was the store at this time. I couldn't get the lawyers. I couldn't get Marvel. I couldn't get Hibbs. I couldn't get anybody to respond. Because what I had figured, and I talked with Kristen, is if I get this, I would give it to her and she would give me credit for it. You know, because it was like about $200-$300 worth of stuff. But all I know is when I closed the shop, I had boxes of Brotherhood. Gruber and I still had a box Deathmate.
He's gonna puke. He's gonna puke.
Oh man, it's been a while since I thought of them, but I had at least half a long box of them. Not the black because it was the first Gen 13, not the red because it was returnable, but the first ones. That was pretty much it. I mean, occasionally I would get stuck with a ton of toys. Like there was a couple Spawn figures that nobody wanted, and I would end up with just that one figure. I couldn't get rid of them because nobody wanted them. I stuck them on the wall and I started doing weird things like, I have no idea what this is, but if you put it on your desk at work, you'll probably get a reaction. Do it for $5.
You know what toy line I remember you having and you couldn't give them away? Little Nicky. McFarlane did a toy line based on that Adam Sandler movie, and everybody thought it was when Adam Sandler was at his peak. And I always called them group home movies because we'd show them at the group home and the kids would watch them over and over and over and over and over and over and laugh at them every time. And I would watch and go, I don't understand. There are no jokes here. And Little Nicky came out, and everybody thought, oh, it's Adam Sandler. It's going to be huge. And it's got all these toy possibilities. And then McFarlane's putting out toys for Little Nicky. And the movie just tanked. Even Adam Sandler fans said, this is shit. And you had those toys. So there's an Adam Sandler action figure. And it's just him looking like a hobo. And, you know, then they had the dog that could shoot missiles out of its crotch and a couple other things.
That was the one that sold because it was so obscene. It made the list of that Reverend
Wildman.
Because every year he'd come up with a top 10 list and McFarlane would always be on it. McFarlane got on that list as a badge of honor. He said if he wasn't on the list, he didn't do good that year.
Yeah.
And that was the only toy that sold. Little Nicky.
Because I remember toward the end, people were looking at it and you go, look, give me a dollar, you can have it. Just get it out of here.
Yeah. And of course, what's that set up for? Because of the flop of Little Nicky, the next toy line didn't sell that, didn't get ordered that well. And if you could see if you remember what it is.
Oh, I wouldn't know. I wasn't. Toys were just something that were over on the wall.
It was Shrek. Because when Shrek came out, nobody knew the movie was going to be that great. Nobody ordered the dragon, which became one of the hottest figures to find because, you know, we were stuck with all these little Mickey toys. We're not going to spend a lot of money on Shrek. Who the hell? Never heard of it. Didn't know. Never last.
And it's Mike Myers. Meh.
Mike Myers. I'm
tired of Austin Powers. Oh, yeah, the Austin Powers figures you had, they didn't sell either.
Well, no, they sold initially. See, the problem with McFarlane's figures were you would get them, and there would always be the one or two, usually the female figures, that would sell really fast. Again, I would get, like, cases of these. I would sell complete sets. But then the ones that were common, those are the ones you got stuck with. And usually when I got a box through a regular retail channel, you know, they would be more, well, we want more Michael Myers figures. We don't want this fat bastard. Again, another figure that went crazy. We want those figures. We don't want all the strange variants. The Fembots, you know, had the guns that would poke out of their breasts. Trying to think of what if there were any other ones that were hot. When Wave 2 came and you had the Heather Graham figure, she was hard to find. I don't think that was a McFarlane line, though. That might have been somebody else.
And, you know, but, Heather Graham herself has become hard to find.
Yeah. Well, she showed up in Hangover.
Yeah, Joe. You realize that was 4 years ago, right?
I don't know. I just watched it on Netflix. All right.
The one I remember from my time at Shinders, it was right after Batman. And Batman, Shinders went whole hog on Batman. We got this box as big as me, full of shirts. And Shinders didn't sell t-shirts. But we put up the t-shirts and they were gone. And then they actually, this was before they got into toys. They got into toys after I left. Because baseball cards took a nosedive. But they got all these Batman toys. Boom, they were gone. So, New Kids on the Block. There was this line of New Kids on the Block. Dolls and shirts and everything. And it was when I was at the Eden Prairie store. And they were convinced they were going to make money hand over fist on the New Kids on the Block. They were going to – we had the tables of remaindered books. We cleared out an entire row of those, devoted a huge section of the store for a New Kids on the Block, almost like a little boutique inside the store. Magazines, books, dolls, shirts. I don't remember what all. And we were told, you know, we had signage. They were going to have ads in the local newspaper. This was going to be big. They were ready. They weren't ready for Batman, but they were ready for this. And they sat and they sat and they sat and they sat and sat and sat and sat. And nobody asked me. Then about 6 months later, one of the VPs was in looking over the store and looking at the table and going, I don't know what we did wrong. And I said, all right, let me help you look around the store. Just pretend you're a casual shopper. Look around the store. What in this store appeals to girls? And finally, this. Yeah. If you look in the window, it's posters of baseball players and football players and baseball cards and football cards and comic books and porn. And there is no reason for a mom to bring her daughters here to see this stuff. This is where you bring your boys, not your girls. We're not getting the people who come in, they aren't looking at it. Why? They're not little girls. And I remember when I left, they still had that table there and they had put remainder prices on everything. They'd dropped the prices they'd cut all the prices in half and it still wasn't selling. So it really depends on making sure you can have great stuff, But if the customers coming in don't care about it, it's going to sit forever. You know, there are bad lines.
I'm just looking at eBay. The Little Nicky figures or any people sell them from 10 to 25 bucks a piece. And then one guy's got a set for 50 bucks, you know. And I'm not going to look up to see if any have sold.
Buy it now.
Well, the problem with eBay is everything's turned into buy it now. The rat bastards running eBay, you know, this is always a beef that I've talked about. You know, Amazon came sniffing around, wanted to be eBay, an auction house. eBay kicked them in the nuts, sent them back home. Then this Bobo that's in there now has no idea what he had, totally has pissed away the auctions. And now eBay's just a poor man's Amazon. And really, 90% of the people, if you're going to buy something, they just go to Amazon. They don't go to eBay. That's right. Just not the way they work. So my moral, don't buy eBay stock. If you have it, get rid of it. What was the other one?
So what I actually hit eBay. I was going to do some bottom feeding because with all my overtime, it's like, you know, I could pick up some comics.
Yeah, some stuff I missed. Comics, collectibles and comics are about the only thing that really is, that I'm aware of that's cranking pretty good on eBay.
However, there were a few where, you know, I'm looking at the comic lots. It's like, oh, here's the entire run of Generation Hope. I didn't pay any attention to it, but now that Hope's kind of a major character and Kieran Gillen's become one of Marvel's bigger writers, it's okay. I'll order that and it's, you know, 99-cent auction. And I go in and I put $5 down. Oh, I'm sorry, you didn't meet the minimum. Why are you going to start your auction at 99 cents if you've got a minimum?
Some people do that.
I tried a couple others, and they all were like that. And it's, forget it. I'm done. I'm out of here. I'm not going to waste my time. There were a few that were penny auctions. You know, oh, we're starting all our auctions at a penny. Yeah, but then you have a minimum. And the problem with it is it doesn't say what the minimum is. You just have to keep betting.
Yeah.
Waste of my time. So I went to the library.
When I was doing eBay, and once I get off the road, you know, I'll be talking more about the eBay auctions I've done. Because, you know, if you listen to earlier podcasts, I'm always got something I'm selling.
Like hobos that, you know, and dig dogs.
Nah, I'm hoarding those. But it was like, if I was going to do an auction, I rarely did a reserve auction. And when I used to do auctions for other people, I would try to talk them out of doing reserves. Because I was like, you know, what you're going to find out is you're going to find out what people are willing to pay, maybe not necessarily what you're willing to get. I always figured there was two things you do with there. Either just sell it, hey, I want 20 bucks for it. Or start it at a buck and let it fly. And that's usually what I do most of my auctions at because, you know, I'm not trying to get, I'd like to get my money back, but most of the time I'm just trying to get rid of it because I got so much crap already. To close out our eBay talk, I did find one Shrek dragon and it's selling for about what it did back when I had my shop. 80 bucks, buy it now. You bid 40 on it. And that seems to be the only one there. Most of the Shrek toys are the newer generation ones. A couple of the old, there's the big Shrek for 70 bucks. Donkey. I mean, I remember opening one for my kids to play with and, you know, the ears got ripped off and Lord knows what happened to everything else. There's a Fiona for 30 bucks. Let's see, there's a Shrek 20. Yeah. Again, these are all buy it now. Nobody's doing auctions.
Bastards.
eBay, you disappoint me.
Damn them all.
And that's my freaking. Hey, let's go into geeking and freaking as long as we're talking about stuff.
Yeah, might as well. We're at 30 minutes. So, Joe, what you geeking on? What you loving?
It is the 70th anniversary of one of my all-time favorite movies, Casablanca.
Ah.
Love it, love it, love it. And I just, Bogart, he looks so cool when he doffs that fedora, cooler than any white man has the right to be. I mean, there's just, it's one of those movies when I read about how they made it, how things just fell together, and it just ends up being such a classic. I have it with me. I watch it almost every time. The first thing I do when I get ready to roll, and you know, there's a lot of articles coming out, a lot of memorabilia surfacing, a lot of facts that nobody's talked about. So I'm kind of digging that. And I, of course, somewhere along the line, if it's not out already, there will be a 70th anniversary Casablanca, which I'll probably buy to go along with my 65th anniversary Casablanca set and my 60th anniversary Casablanca set, not to mention my regular anniversary. The one thing I don't have yet, I don't have a Blu-ray. And usually what happens is that the sets, they always pop in a couple extra things, which is really cool. I remember when I was cleaning out, I mean, I fall for this crap. I remember cleaning out my old videotapes, and I discovered I had three different versions of Beatles' Hard Day's Night. Fortunately, I just bundled them together and sold them on eBay. So,
now, if you find a copy of Let It Be.
I don't know if there ever was one.
There was one.
They did mix,
I rented
they
it.
Did mix, they mixed stuff in, I know, with the Beatles anthology. But, yeah, that original one is, boy, if you had it and needed money, you know, that would be the one to blow out.
There was a video store in
Paul or somebody cacks before that one gets released. They've released everything else.
Well, I haven't found Magical Mystery Tour either.
I have it. That was out.
No.
That was in, if you, you might be able to find it. It was for a while like a $10, $20 DVD at Best Buy, but it was always in the music video section. It wasn't in like the regular musicals or
okay.
the regular DVD. So you might be able to find it.
Well, we'll get back to Let It Be, but I have a Casablanca story.
Uh-oh.
There was a woman I was dating a couple of years ago. And, you know, we're just starting to date, and she wants to have a movie night. And we're, you know, she said, well, bring over a couple movies that you think I'll really like that I haven't seen. And I knew that she didn't watch a lot of older movies, so I brought over Casablanca, as well as, you know, some more recent stuff. And she saw Casablanca and kind of turned up her nose at it. And I said, well, no, it's really good. It's a classic. She said, it's old. What do you mean it's old? It's old. And she said, and I swear to God, when we have movie night, you can't bring anything that was made before 2005. Joe, at that moment, I should have run for the hills. Any woman who wouldn't want to see Casablanca is not a woman you want to spend any time with.
I figure for me, it's Jane, Silent Bob, Strike Back. If I have a woman who doesn't want to see it, forget it. Fortunately, my beloved wife, we were that day. We've had one of those days. Throw in Jane, Silent Bob, Strike Back.
But Let It Be, the only reason I know it came out on video, there was a video store on Hennepin about two blocks down from my favorite coffee house on Common Grounds. And they had weird, obscure videos. And it was VHS. DVD killed them. Which is sad because most of their stuff they could have got on DVD cheaper. But they had, you know, they had what was new. But in their case, in the glass case at the center of the store that they stood behind, they had the Best Picture movie from every year. All the way back to 29 was Wings. They had them all, every Best Picture winner. On videotape. They had a wall of psychotropic films. They had all the Russ Meyer movies. Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill. Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens. All that stuff. That's where I found out about the Sinister Cinema. Because I asked them, oh, what are these drive-in double features? Oh, it's a company called Sinister Cinema. They put these out. And we could talk about that next time, how I still use your store to get a discount from them. But all these wonderful, old, weird movies you're not going to find anywhere, although now they're starting to turn up on Turner Classic. It's where I first saw the movie Head.
I think I have
the
video
movie.
Yeah.
But now they show that about every year or two on Turner Classic. And the cameos in it are what makes the movie for me. Yeah, the movie itself is just very, very, very strange.
Yeah.
but the people they were eating. Frank Zappa's
in the movie. What the should have done, they should have just done the campy, crappy, funny things that they were tired of doing. Give us one of those movies, then do Head, and they might have lasted a little longer. I mean, they hung around for a while, and some of their best music came out after this, after they started doing their own stuff. But it's kind of bad as if you ever get the Rhino collections, you know, it's like there were four, then there were three, and then just two. I think Mickey and Davey hung out just to finish the contract up. In other words, the record company had to do it because they had the contract.
Yeah, contractual obligation albums.
And then that was a 70, and then of course, it was it 86, I think, they started their, no, it was earlier than that. They started the comeback tour.
85 was when MTV started running it.
Yeah, because and I remember.
Oh my gosh, everybody loves the Monkees again.
Well, they had always been loved. They were in syndication. That's how I discovered the show. And somehow I ended up with a little Corgi Jr. of the Monkey Mobile. I must have been given that in the 70s. Because I think what happened was is as soon as it went off NBC, it was at CBS or somebody picked it up, threw it in the Saturday morning reruns and kept it rerunning for a while. I caught it just in standard syndication play. And I remember I stayed up once and I think it's Care 11 if you're ever in Minneapolis. Back then it was called WTCN. And I noticed they were running Monkees at like 3 in the morning. And I thought, okay, I'll get my ass up and watch it. So, you know, this was probably 76, maybe 77. You know, it
remember
just
the old days
when
you had to wake up and watch something if it was on in the middle of the night?
Well, and this was new, too, because it used to be TV programs, which the stations would shut down at midnight and come back at 1 or like 6 a.m. or something. You know, I mean, the idea of a test pattern, nobody gets it anymore. So
and
I got up.
The national anthem and sermonette.
And start. Yep. And I would have liked to get up super, super early because then they'd talk about tonight on Emergency. Roy and DeSoto get in trouble with a rattlesnake or whatever. anyways. So I got up and I'm already watching the Monkees and they basically break right into it. They totally skipped over the teaser, the opening credits. It was on for 2 minutes. Then it was like 6 minutes of commercials, on for another 3 minutes. Another 6 minutes of commercials. Then they got to another 3 minutes and they got to the song. They cut that out. Then they went for 10 minutes commercials. Then they went into the next show. I was like, wow, that's effed up. Now I have the Rhino release on them. And if you picked up the original Rhino release, you don't have to pick up the re-release because I guess they haven't added anything new to it. And I will add a mini freaking here.
Okay.
The Monkees tour just went through Minneapolis. Where am I? Liberal, Kansas.
Liberal, Kansas.
This is kind of a, they're not calling it a goodbye to Davey tour, but they're just, you know, it's, they're playing the hits. They, I guess run a couple of videos where Davey's singing. They even do, one of the songs, I think it's Daydream Believer, where they just play and the audience sings along, you know, it's just, whatever happens. And, you know, they're doing limited number of dates.
And Nesmith is with them this time, right?
Yeah, Nez is with them. So, yeah, we'll get to freaking later.
Okay.
The other things I'm geeking on, I did finally read the custom edition, not for resale, version of the Avengers Season 1 graphic novel that was included in the Walmart exclusive DVD of the Avengers movie. Those of you recall, I still cannot watch the Avenger movie because of my computer effed up. However, and you know what the weird thing is, Corey, you sent me some, what do you call them, freeware that I could download and play.
DVDs.
I installed it. Whatever code is inside my stupid computer automatically the minute a DVD goes in there, it looks for the program that was corrupt and is no longer on my computer. So even if I tell it, no, go to this program, it keeps going back to the original program. I got two words for Dell, but since I don't want to rate it R on this podcast, I'm just going on to what I'm geeking about. Hence, the Avengers Season 1 graphic novel. This one is kind of neat because it was written by Peter David, art by a whole bunch of people, nobody I recognize. And essentially what it is, it's an all-new graphic novel, kind of modernizing the first days after, like, well, probably after, like, Avengers 4 or something, because they refer to the fact that Ant-Man and Wasp are not with them, but it deals primarily with Thor, Captain America, Iron Man, and Hulk. And basically, Loki tries another round of tricking them. And this is back when they don't know each other that well. They're wary around each other. And I'll just read off the back. And there came a day like any other. Boy, I wish Ted Knight was still around. Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice.
The Earth's mightiest heroes found themselves united against a common threat, and on that day, the Avengers were born. But what happened the next day? You'll only think you know the story. And it's very compelling read. I sat down and read it in one night. I had actually planned to read it over a course of a couple nights. The only thing I don't like about it is that it's got that stupid-ass black cover. The minute you put your fingerprint on it, boom, it's there. Oh, I hate those things.
Just a reminder to anybody who's working in the comic industry, black covers, we don't like them.
No, sir.
Don't like
it. And I finally cracked the plastic off my Empowered Volume 7. Obviously, I've been carrying this around a lot because I got dent marks in the back cover. And this one has a different thing where it has glossy black pages. So I can tell where I've read because every single page has a fingerprint where I had the whole page. Adam Warren, you're not getting a Christmas card this year. Empowered, we've talked about before. It's from Dark Horse. If you want to give it a quick peek, they have various comic book editions you can try for cheap. But essentially, it's wrapped because it's radar. This rather buxom, curvaceous blonde wants to be a costume crime fighter. But what happens is as her costume gets torn, her powers disappear, and consequently, she usually finds herself tied up by the supervillains. And of course, when she somehow gets saved, that usually means her fellow heroes really don't like her that much. The last volume got really, really dark. They had a character called Phosphorus Pete, or Willie Pete, that came in. He's basically living Phosphorus, and he just wiped out a thug, a whole run of heroes in a horrendous way. And while they were doing it, a mind reader was listening in, and she was vividly describing the heroes as they were dying off one by one. And it was just, I mean, for such a lighthearted series to take such a dark turn just was amazing. Anyways, this issue is kind of fun because, you know, it's got super villainous minivans, dueling daddy issues, doomed but still hot boyfriends, undead karaoke party crashers, and spoiler alerts from hell itself, prophesized by diabolically omnificent demon spawns. If that doesn't have you pausing the podcast to run out and buy it, I don't know you people anymore. Oh, the other thing I'm geeking on is just my geek, because anyway, I finally found two more Hot Wheels I've been looking for. I got the Batmobile Matchbox, but they changed colors on it, so I still need the original color. And I did find the Mars Rover Curiosity, so now when I'm at work, I can just have Curiosity driving over all sorts of things. Kind of like Moon Rover, the old video game where you
oh, yeah.
jump over robots and pits and spikes and Speaking of which, there's a shop in town called,
Rusty Quarters.
Yes. We will have to check that out when I get home and see what it's all about.
Yeah, I remember hearing about them as they were saying, we're not going to last much longer. We're doomed. No, but they, obviously they must have survived.
Well, they still got a Facebook, whether it's being updated or not.
No, because one of our old friends from the shop, Tim Kaiser, was actually there today.
Ah, that's who I saw it from. So anyways, that's all I'm geeking on. Wait, there's one more thing I geeked on. I finally visited the final tourist thing in Liberal. I went down and checked out the Dorothy House.
Oh, good. You finally got in.
Yeah. What it is, it's next to a, it's kind of weird because they have a tour information spot up front, which is basically run by the state of Kansas. And they have all sorts of stuff that say Liberal, that say Kansas, that say Wizard of Oz. So if you weren't paying attention, like one of my coworkers wasn't, she went in and started asking all about, well, what is this Dorothy House? And the mouth breather behind the counter, she's just there. And she's like, I don't know. So she said, well, if they didn't know any information. Well, the thing was that the Dorothy House is actually connected to the city of Liberal, I believe, and not, or maybe the county, because there's an art museum next door. And I forget the name of the, there was a conquistador, a Spanish conquistador, that they actually found artifacts here. Because this is like as far north, Kansas was as far north as he went when they were touristing, looking for the city of gold and whatever. So they have a statue of him out front. They have a big exhibit. There's a someone from Liberal, and I don't know her name because, again, it's all in my pile of goodies that I get. But they have a little NASA exhibit because apparently this female astronaut was up in the space shuttle. So she brought back some stuff to show off. But in the art house museum, that's where you buy the tickets, and then they have this one of the volunteers or maybe employees dresses up like Dorothy, and then she brings you into the Dorothy Museum. And it was kind of funny because it was a very young black girl with short, straight, cropped hair. And as we were waiting in front of the movie of Wizard of Oz that plays on and on and on, much probably to the chagrin of the people that were there, one of the little six-year-olds was like, where's Dorothy? And the dad's like, well, there she is right there. Because she's, you know, this black girl and, you know, teenager. You know, she looks young. Everybody looks young to me. And she was pretty. And the girl looks at her and goes, that's not Dorothy. And I'm like, oh, boy, here it comes. Dorothy's got pigtails. And I'm like, oh, God bless little children. They don't notice. And she kept going on, but Dorothy doesn't have things. And finally I looked at her and said, well, you know, there are other stories beyond Wizard of Oz. Dorothy goes back to Oz. Is that true, Dad? And the dad's relieved going, yes, it is. Like, I mean, what would you want to do? Stay in Kansas or go to Oz? So that seemed to satisfy the girl.
Well, that's good.
Anyway, the tour itself, they have a small replica of the house. There was never any real house, because it was actually just a soundstage that they had done most of the filming. It's the same soundstage that Wheel of Fortune films on now. But inside the house, they have different artifacts from that era. Like, you have an ice box where you put the 25-pound block of ice on the top, and that would cool everything underneath it. You have the device that helps separate the eggs. They have a 1902 Sears catalog, the old hand crank, Victoria, you know, for listening to music, a Zenith radio, Yeah, it was what you would typically find in a house, circular 1902 in Kansas. Then you go, once you're done with the house, then you go into the Land of Oz, which is just one of your typical tin buildings. And inside they have replicas of the various scenes of Wizard of Oz. And then all of a sudden, the girl who's leading the tour, up until then, it's like, okay, this is an ice box considering of the turn of the century. You put your 25-pound block of ice and it cools your stuff. And then just real, you know, rote memory. Here's what you have. She can answer questions and stuff, but, you know, obviously not the fun part of the tour. When she gets into the Land of Oz, she says, okay, now I'm going to recreate the Land of Oz. There's a twister. Now here I am in the back of the line. What the hell? And then I realize what she's doing. She's acting out this stuff. And as you go through, it's, you know, different scenes. About halfway through, I realized I would get better pictures if I turned my flash on, but it was kind of fun. But the most interesting thing was at the very end, she brought the tour group to the left. I veered off to the right because there was this huge room with glass cases full of various artifacts from Wizard of Oz throughout the years. I found, like, you know, collector plates that you could probably find now. I found, you know, books from probably not first edition, but, you know, through the earliest one was like a 1902, the different versions up to almost date. Then they had a long glass showcase filled with different things, and I started looking at it, and then all of a sudden she comes in. Well, other people had filtered in, and she's like, oh, you can't come in here. There's a birthday party here, and you can't come in. And everybody looks at her, really? There's nobody here. And I said, I don't want them stealing the balloons because they're balloons. You know, I was satisfied. I got in there first. I was able to at least look at everything, probably not look at as much as I wanted to. I mean, they had a little exhibit with some of the toys and a couple model mock-ups. But I took tons of pictures of this, and I'll figure out which ones are worth putting on my Facebook. So that was it. I've done the last touristy thing here there is to do. I'm ready to go home.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back in Minnesota, what are you geeking on, Corey, other than snow?
Well, the first thing I am geeking on is a book that came out a little while back. And it's called, what is it? Creepy Presents Richard Corbin. And it's a book from Dark Horse that reprints all of the stories that artist Richard Corbin did for Warren magazines. Warren published Creepy, Eerie, Vampirella. I think there are also some stories in there from 1984, which turned into 1994. Richard Corbin started as an underground artist. He did a lot of underground horror work, and he would do airbrushed art. And eventually he came to Warren, and his art didn't look like anything else they were doing at Warren, because they were doing the traditional, you know, pencil, ink. There were some artists who would draw directly to ink. They would use some different techniques. I've talked in the past. Some of Steve Ditko's most beautiful work is in the Warren magazines, because what he would do, he would pencil it, and then rather than using a pen or a brush to ink, he would take the ink and you do an ink wash, which gives you different gradations, and the art just looks really, for black and white, you get a lot of really good shading. When you look at Corbin's black and white work in this, again, his early stuff, you see how he becomes better as an artist. But the other thing I want to mention about the book is that Corbin was one of the artists that they printed in color later in Warren. They would have the black and white magazine, but there would be a color section. And Corbin was one of the guys who did it, and it was all recolored by a colorist, and I will butcher this name because that's what we do here, Jose Villarubia, or Villaruba. He does a lot of coloring for Marvel, for DC, And if you go to his Facebook page, what he's doing now, he's showing side by side for the art he's doing now, what the penciled and inked art looks like, and then what he did with the coloring, so that you can see how the coloring is part of the art when he does it. But the thing about Corbin is his art is really hard to color because he uses that airbrush technique. And usually when people recolor stuff using modern techniques, it really looks terrible. The example I always use is when Neil Adams wants to recolor his stuff. It's bright and the colors don't work because the art was drawn for the four color process. And I love Neil Adams, but don't let him correct his old work. Just let it be.
You hear that, Lucas?
Well, he can't do it anymore. But Villarubia does a beautiful job of blending the color in with Corbin's art. Another thing about the Warren stuff is you get a lot of writers on their way up. So some of the stories can be a little goofy. There are some that are more, that's a good idea rather than a good story. But it's over 400 pages. As it goes on, the art just becomes beautiful to look at. And if you want more examples of Richard Corbin's art, he did a adaptation of two of my favorite Harlan Ellison short stories, Boy and His Dog and Blood's a Rover.
I've got.
Do you remember those?
It's actually a signed hardcover edition. And I also, my first exposure to it was the Don Johnson Boy and His Dog movie.
Yes. And I hadn't read the sequel. I hadn't read the sequel till the comic because I didn't know there was a sequel. And then, oh, look, here's a sequel to that story. And then I went back and I found where Ellison had published it. But that's another example of Corbin's art being colored. He's also done some stuff for Marvel. He did the Marvel Max Luke Cage miniseries. I think it was just called Cage. And he did the Punisher The End that Garth Ennis wrote. But this Creepy Presents Richard Corbin is just a beautiful, beautiful book. And next time you're at the shop, just flip through it to see his art style. And even if the stories weren't that great.
It's not one of those that comes shrink-wrapped, is it?
I don't know.
That's one of those things that drive me nuts because it's like, if you have this book you want to look at and it's shrink-wrapped. You know, more astute retailers will at least have a unshrink-wrapped copy you can look at.
next thing I'm geeking on.
How big a book is it?
Over 400 pages, and it's the size of the Warren magazine. So it's,
magazine
size.
So you might have to go online to look for some examples, but I bet if you went to a good shop like Dreamhaven or The Source, they might have a unbound copy you could look at.
NaNoWriMo, I'm nearing the end. I have 10,000 words to write and 6 days to do it. And the story's progressing very, very well.
Or did Richard Rodrigo do it? Hornswoggle.
I'm not going to say
Vern Gagne
did
it, but he didn't know it.
Actually, Vern Gagne, there's a version of Vern Gagne in the book. And I really like the conversation the lead character, the protagonist, has with Greg Gagne. You know, it's not Greg Gagne, but it's Greg Gagne, where they talk about what it was like for him as, you know what, he's the son of the guy who owns the Federation. He's not that good, but he keeps being put in the role of, you know, he could never be a bad guy. He always had to be kind of a focus, you know.
He couldn't be a WWE.
Well, and there was that tradition back then of the sons getting into wrestling. Look at the Von Erichs. And,
see, when I got into AWA,
there were some others.
Gagne was big with, or Greg was big with Jim Brunzell as the High Flyers. They were having a hell of a feud against East West Connection, which was Adrian Adonis and Jesse Ventura. And it was just, I mean, it was amazing. And of course, you're always thinking, you know, eventually Greg would get his shot against, I think it was Nick Bockwinkel at the time. I don't ever recall if I saw it or not. Cause you know, the Gagne's, I hated the Heenan family. Oh man, I'm old school.
Novel's going along very well. I think next time.
Are you going to do like every other guy and just lock it away forever? Or will you actually put a link on our website so people can download it and read it?
Well, what I'm going to do is I put it away for a month and don't look at it and don't think about it. And then I'm going to go back and start the editing process.
We're never going to see it, folks. Never.
Well, I don't know. The first four I've written are up on the Solitaire Rose website.
Okay, I'm holding you to it. Because I've seen you do this year after year and have yet to see a single. What? There was one year you did send me a manuscript. That was on the last laptop whose hard drive died. I think it was was that the year you did a zombie crime?
No, I've just done zombie.
Yeah. Well, it was, you were doing something from one point of view, and I don't know if you're going to try to do it from the zombie, and then you had to stop or something because it wasn't working, or I don't remember. All I remember was looking forward to it, and then the damn laptop died and took everything with it.
The other two geeking I have actually leads to a bit of an announcement about the show, Joe. Ooh.
Episode?
Yeah. As you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Oh, that little season just erupted. You're not ready for it. I mean, you guys, you're talking a lot of podcasts.
Well, when I'm at the gym, I listen to podcasts. To
all the old folks he's entitled, he is entrusted with. He has nothing else to do but to podcast. Listen. Or as I call it, stealing.
But if you go over to the official Crazy Comics and Stuff podcast page, you'll see that there are
unofficial ones out there.
There are?
We'll talk later.
You will see, first off, a podcast called, it comes up as Smodcast, Mark Hamill, the People's Joker, but the title of that one, it's Kevin Smith's Fat Man on Batman, where he interviews people who've been involved in Batman, both the comic, the TV show, the movie. And I listened to the two-parter with Mark Hamill, who was the voice of the Joker, pretty much from the animated series on. And it's a two-parter, so it's over a three-hour conversation with Mark Hamill, talking about voiceover work, his early years, very little about Star Wars, because Star Wars has been covered in so many other interviews. And by the end of it, you really feel like you just sat down and had a long conversation with Mark Hamill. Because I'm not going to say anything bad about regular interview style, which is you come in, you have your questions, and you're going to go through. This really felt like two friends just sitting down and talking, kind of like what we do. And then the other one I have is WTF with Mark Maron. Mark Maron is a comedian. He's done radio. He's done TV. He's mostly a stand-up comic. And he started doing a podcast, WTF, where he sits in his garage and interviews comedians and actors and people like that. And there's another podcast that I've mentioned called The Art of Wrestling with Colt Cabana. Colt Cabana became a very big fan of podcasting, and especially Mark Maron's WTF. So what Colt Cabana does is he sits down in the studio apartment and interviews professional wrestlers, telling road stories, you know, kind of like what they talk about in the locker room or when they're in the car. So on WTF, Mark Maron interviewed Colt Cabana. And Mark Maron knows nothing about professional wrestling other than when he was a kid, he saw the magazines on the stands and they scared him to death, because it's always, the magazines back then were tubby guys in leotards with blood all over their faces and somebody beating the hell out of them. So Marin interviews Colt Cabana, not knowing much about wrestling, but wanting to learn. But he does a 20-minute intro where he talks about how he, after the interview, was so interested in professional wrestling, he started doing research, and he found this essay by a French intellectual from the 50s talking about American professional wrestling on television and what it meant and what it embodied and why people liked it. Now, there are two great, amazing podcasts, wonderful to listen to, but I've kind of been, you know, I've said here on the show time and again, oh, I'm going to do a solo podcast coming up later on where I do blah, 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 or this or that. And I've never really done it because the podcast Joe and I do is called Crazy Comics and Stories. And I really thought, well, I can't do a crazy podcast if Cray's not on it.
True. He does have a picture of me that he sets up, and I know for a fact he lets his cat piddle on it, but
I don't let the same. Her. Just does.
No, she does that to me when I show up.
Well, that's
true. I
got
a warm lap.
So within the next month or two, I'm going to be starting kind of a spinoff podcast. It will be part of the Crazy feed. And I haven't decided on the name on it yet, but I'm thinking something to do with Solitaire Rose, because the Solitaire Rose family of podcasts. And I've got two or three different things that I'm going to be doing, because I'm also listening to the Daily Rios, which Peter Rios, who used to be on Comic Geek Speak, now does the solo one, where every day he turns on the microphone and records. And some days it's an hour, and some days it's 3 minutes. What it's going to be, I'm going to do different podcasts. Some of them will be where I talk about the history of comics. And I'm going to finally do the Kirby episode, and it may turn into more than just one, where I go through and talk about the history of comics. The ideas I have right now are kind of a personal history of Jack Kirby. The other idea I have is a complete history of EC Comics. First the business end, then going through each series, talking about the stories, then talking about the artists involved. And the other will be an interview, but I don't want it to be like the interviews they do on Word Balloon or Comic Geek Speak. I want it to just be a conversation. And Joe, I'm going to tell you the first person I have lined up for this.
Ooh, are you ready? Exclusive. I like it.
Mike Johnson from PW Insider and I are going to have a conversation about comic books and the entertainment industry and what he does as a professional wrestling journalist. And we're going to be recording that in about a week or two.
Oh,
and that will
be
probably be the first episode. It will be part of the Crazy feed, but it will have a different name. So if you're looking on your iTunes and all of a sudden you see, huh, under the Crazy Comics and Stuff, Comics and Stories podcast, it's got Solitaire Rose, blah, blah, blah. Those are the solo ones that I'll be doing. Now, here's the thing about the solo ones. I emailed Joe, and Joe might even sit in on some of them.
Because Corey, depending too, on, has a warm lap.
So that's one of the ideas that's going to be starting up within by the end of the year. And those two podcasts are really what kind of got the gears going. So that's what I'm geeking on. Joe, what you freaking on?
I'm in Liberal, Kansas.
How much longer? When do you leave? What?
3 weeks, which by the time the podcast goes up, unless you do a super fast turnaround, usually about a week, be about 2 weeks. I get to go home, December 15th.
Okay.
So it's going to be another fun ride home, because the night before we're all going to go down to Amarillo, Texas and go check out the home of the old 96er. 4 pounds of pure Texan Angus beef. I'm not going to eat it, but one of the guys going with us is going to try.
Are you going to stop?
And then, of course, we're not going to leave until like 6 p.m. here. We'll be 8 p.m. there. couple hours to eat. We're going to get back at midnight. I got to leave by 4 to get to the airport at 5 to catch 6 o'clock flight. I'm going to have a hell of a long layover in Denver, and then I'll get here probably about 7 p.m. Yeah, I'm kind of freaking about that, but that's okay. It'll be fun.
And if I remember right, this is your last deployment.
No, not necessarily. My contract is up in March, maybe. Depends on how fast they – what they do is they have a whole process where they evaluate to see if I am worthy enough to stay on the road. Then they have to ask the federal security director at my airport if they may ask if I may stay on the road. Then they ask me if I want to stay on the road. And then they tally how many people say yes, how many people say no. Then they figure out how many people they need because they have a set number they want and are budgeted for the way things are going now. And then they open it up to anybody nationwide that's currently on the TSA. And judging by the amount of people I've met that are newbies, there's a lot of people interested. This program, it's not secret. It's not hidden. It's just not well known. But what's happening is because we've been called on to do so many different missions. I mean, when Hurricane Sandy hit, about 170 people went out to help at the airports. And this was just at the airport, you know, and there were three airports that were hit critically. Two of them, I mean, flooded to the point they couldn't use them, LaGuardia and JFK. Newark was down. There were a couple other ones that were closed. I don't know how Baltimore did. Anyways, 80 National Deployment Force officers went out. I didn't get called because if I get pulled out, they're going to be short here. They won't be able to do what they need to do. But I know a bunch of ours went. 25 officers went from Minneapolis that are on a volunteer emergency surge force. And they went, and what they do is they guard the secure area of the airport. We call it the sterile area. It's the area between – or the area between right beyond the checkpoint and right by the gate where you go onto the jetway to get onto the plane. This is an area that TSA and the security companies before it maintain as weapons-free, hence it's called the sterile area. And it's just for passengers that have tickets now. It used to be anybody could go in there, and then they changed that. Sometime after 9/11, they made it so only ticketed passengers could go through. You know, employees, police, FBI, you know, there's all sorts of people back there. But if one of these areas collapses or breaches, it's hellacious to reestablish it. I talked about when I was out in Vegas, they have that brand new terminal that's a half mile long. It took 4 days to get that area secure to be certified that it was sterile because, you know, they're looking to make sure nobody's hidden anything under the seats. There's nothing that should be where it shouldn't be. There's nothing underneath the fake ceiling panels. You know, they didn't want somebody to, you know, accidentally leave, you know, some bomb making explosive materials here, knowing that somebody's going to come through as soon as it's open and gather this stuff up. I mean, they're really giving these places the full money. To lose a sterile area in the airports the size of the ones in Manhattan would be, I mean, it would have taken months to reopen the place. So these guys, they go in during the height of the hurricane. They are pretty much just sitting there. I mean, there's nobody flying. There's nobody going in and out. There might be vendors trying to protect their wares, but they're there to keep that so that the people who work at those airports can go home, take care of their loved ones, take care of their houses. Once they came back, they worked with the local people to get the airports up and running. And a couple of guys I talked to said, we went down in the basement. It's flooded. It's stinky. It's messy. But it still works. The conveyor belts work. The x-ray machines work. Electronic equipment works. If you've been paying at all attention to what was going on, you know that they shut down a lot of the subway equipment. And then they had to go in and pump the water out. And then they had to inspect it. I don't even know if these tunnels are even open underneath the rivers, you know, between, you know, New York and Manhattan, Brooklyn, Staten Island. Because
they
get soaked,
and I know
water,
why.
What happened?
Were they able to get them cleared?
Fresh water?
Well, I should say, I know that they are open because this morning on the new show I watch, Up with Chris Hayes, they talked about, you know, what are you thankful for? And he said he is thankful that the subways are open and running because that's how he gets to work.
Yeah, because they were really worried. I mean, salt water, water is bad enough. Salt water corrodes electronics. So once you pump it out, then you have to worry about, well, how much damage did the salt do to the electrical components? Unless they were able to flush it with fresh water, which would wash it away, then they just have to deal with, is there any damage? So that's good to hear, because I know a number of people that I've met that are out there, and it's good to hear things are back. What the hell prompted this question?
Freaking.
Okay.
I was asking, you know, are you getting off the road? And it sounds like, well, you've got a vote in whether you get off the road or not.
Yeah.
But you've just got one vote.
I commit to a contract for a year. Yeah. And really, after 4 years of doing this, I'm looking to get off. I want to stay home. I've got basements full of whatever to sell on eBay. So once I'm home and established, that'll be my pimping of the week. Actually, that might be a new section in Crazy. What am I pimping on eBay this week? That's the future. The other book that I'm kind of disappointed at that I was actually looking forward to, I had Gruber pull me a copy of Uncanny X-Men number 20, because when I read this, this was supposed to be like Cyclops' big to do with, you know, because he's been incarcerated after the whole Phoenix thing. I don't know if you want to throw a spoiler warning up for people who care. But
there you go. There's your spoiler warning.
They pulled a plot line that I absolutely hate. The end of Uncanny X-Men 20, you discover the person that's been interviewing Cyclops is actually Mr. Sinister. Of course, if you were paying attention to the crossovers, the Phoenix had a big-ass fight with Mr. Sinister where he rebuffed them and eventually died. This is, what, his fifth death? But no, he's still around. He's still out here, and Cyclops is the only one that knows about it, because apparently during this entire interview, nobody thought, hey, we should have a microphone or a camera on this guy. And if they did, they just accidentally, it would certainly malfunction. And you think you got the number one terrorist currently in the Marvel Universe incarcerated, and everybody, you know, other than holes bigger than the one that Malibu put through Protectors number 5. Boring, cliched, dull. I mean, come on. We just killed the villain, but he's back. I am so tired of all these guys in X-Men. It's one of those, it smacks up everything you know is wrong. No, Cyclops didn't happen to jump out of an airplane that was being pulled down. No, Mr. Sinister shot. And it wasn't that he and Havoc got separated, they didn't know each other. Mr. Sinister did that. And it wasn't that Charles Xavier had hotsy-totsies for a 16-year-old Jean Grey. Mr. Sinister... No, wait a minute. That was Xavier. Anyways, it was the same thing with Wolverine. You know, he's not just some mutant from the 1860s that's been brainwashed over and over, who got all his memories back, that people went psychotically apeshit to burn everything because you just said those words. Wolverine's got his memory. And people went nuts. They killed themselves. No, it was all done by, what was this Bobo's name? Romulus? He's been manipulating him the entire time. Is there anybody in the frickin' X-Men universe that hasn't been manipulated since the dawn of time? To me,
let me put it this way: the Romulus thing. I'm thinking that's a Gwen's kid thing. Where yeah, they're never going to refer to that again.
They keep coming back to it. This is like the third time he came back, and he was supposedly dead, but no, he came back, and now his daughter's back, and oh, sweet bejesus, this is just. I hope Bendis does something with X-Men because this single issue's almost got me ready to just stop X-Men altogether because it just sucks with a capital S. And I just, obviously I'm freaking because when's the last time I got this agitated about a comic?
When was our last episode?
I don't remember. It was a big three-parter, so it was fun. this is stupid. I mean, I would have just let the character die, but it's, you know, and then they're like, unless they're doing this because, Bendis has a great idea that he wants to, you know, do with Mr. Sinister that might blow us out of the water. Kind of like what they just announced. Oh, I'm going back into geeking. Brian Bendis prepares Age of Ultron for 2013.
Yes. We've been hearing about it for 4 years.
Sweet bejesus. And he had the free comic giveaway or the Marvel 12.1, which I stupidly bought as well, where they refer to that he's back. Ultron's back. And what I find is interesting is apparently we're not going to see how he invades the world because we've actually seen that already. I think Kurt Busiek did that in his run where Ultron slowly took over the Marvel Universe. We're going to join with the Conquest Complete. And he talks about the ending that is so going to be so mind-boggling that nobody has guessed it. And the article I read in comicresources.com where he talks about the guy talks or he interviews Bendis and he says, what is Bendis really into? He says, what I'm most excited about is that our ending is such a whopper that nobody has guessed it. And every couple of days I go, really? And, the artist, if I'm going to pronounce his name, Brevoort, saying it's a very lucky guess if somebody happens to come across it and they're keeping it locked down with codes and stuff. And of course the reporter starts thinking, could be the introduction of Marvel Man, could be the reporter himself being given $1 million. Speaking of which, as soon as we're done with the podcast, I got to see if I won the, lottery. You want to see some podcasting if I win that jackpot. Anyways.
If you win that, we're going to make Kevin Smith look like a piker.
My guess, and I'm going to go with Rom returns. Because I found a couple interesting things about Rom. First of all, Parker Brothers, aka Hasbro, doesn't necessarily own the rights. Because there was an interview with the brother of the gentleman who created Rom. He got, how do you say the word? Ancillary rights?
Ancillary.
Thank you. He gets those rights, which would refer to the comics because that was extra merchandise. Anything that had to do, you know, if Rom had taken off and become a TV program or a movie, whatever. Because what's happened is there's a group on Facebook trying to get Rom back because they want to use it as a benefit for Bill. Oh, last name fart. Matt Mantlo?
Mantlo.
Thank you. Because he's been in – is he in a coma?
No. He has traumatic brain injury.
Oh,
so
it's – Not this situation.
We have a couple of residents I work with who have that. Mm-hmm. So, the last I read, you know, he's doing okay, but he has times when he gets very violent and times when he gets very confused. And the family has asked, you know, if you're going to send letters, please send letters. He enjoys the letters. They probably sit and read the letters to him. Because we have a resident, well, we had a resident. He has since moved to a different facility. His parents would send him a letter every week. And rather, we would read it to him, and while he wouldn't understand the words, he knew it's a letter from your mom. And he would be able to pick out words, you know, mom, love. He would sing You Are My Sunshine, because I guess they sang that to him when he was a small child. Now, I don't know the details because the family isn't giving a lot of details, but it sounds like it's very much like the residents I work with. So
the guy who owns the rights to Rom, he is suffering from dementia. And that's what got these people thinking now. They're like, well, maybe we could do a convince Marvel, aka Disney, to, you know, wrestle the rights and to be able to do something with Rom to benefit both these people. To me, it's just a Facebook group spinning in the wheels, winds, but then they start touting rumors that Disney's looking for a toy company and Hasbro hasn't been doing so hot. Maybe good, be some good pickings.
And it would give them another cable channel.
Sure. Why not put everybody on there? Hasbro, He-Man, whatever.
Anyway, it's called the Hub.
My guess for the Age of Ultron, which starts in March and ships to June, is Rom Returns. Because Ultron, you know, is up on, what's it called, Glendor or whatever. Whatever the Space Knight's home planet was. And he pretty much took over the entire planet, and then they attacked the Kree during one of the epic battles. I don't know. It was
It was in that Marvel cosmic.
And they don't refer to Rom as Rom. They have to call him the greatest of us all. But it would be epic if to see him come back, you know, in the midst of mankind's darkest computer hour. Let's see, Ultron, lack of Twinkies. I might have to look that up. I'm just in a good mood. How can I turn a freaking into a geeking? I'll turn it over to you. What are you geeking on?
I have talked about this repeatedly, and I'm now reading Marvel Comics, The Untold Story by Sean Howell. And I'm about 90 pages in, and it's one of the Untold Story, well, pretty much everything in here so far I have known, except for the stuff about Jim Sterdanko basically being a gun runner and a car thief when he was a kid.
Hey, everybody's got to have a hobby. If it happened before age 30, it didn't count, which he told me when I was 40. So thanks a lot, George.
So I'm going to read a section from the book that every time I read stuff like this, it makes my blood boil.
I love story times. Let me get snugged in and pull up a good old heaping bowl of grape nuts.
All right, they're talking about the Comics Code in 1954. If a book didn't have a Comics Code seal, distributors wouldn't touch it. EC Comics, with its brilliant but hard crime and horror titles, shut down its entire comic book line, although one title, Mad, was reformatted into a magazine. Comic books defanged just as television sales were, skyrocketing and rock and roll was beginning, lost their momentum. In the 2 years that followed the Wortham Crusade, the number of titles produced by comic industry was halved. Companies folded left and right. Timely Comics cut its budget drastically, paying less and less each month to freelancers, etc., etc., etc. Okay. Mad did not become a magazine to avoid the Comics Code. Mad became a magazine because Harvey Kurtzman was getting offers from magazine publishers. And he went into the office one day and demanded that Mad be made into a magazine or he would walk. And Mad was EC's highest selling comic, so Gaines said, sure, we'll do it. We'll figure out how to do it. We'll do Mad as a quarterly magazine. Comic sales were going down, yes, because TV was becoming more ubiquitous. But the whole, if it didn't have the code seal on it, they didn't sell it. whenever I hear that, I just think you've just proven you don't know anything about comics history, because Dell Comics, the number one comic publisher until the mid-70s, never had the code. Walt Disney's comics and stories, which sold between 3 and 5 million copies all through the 50s, never submitted to the code. They just didn't do it. Distributors didn't care. It's Dell Comics. Look, they've got the Disney books. They've got the Warner Brothers books. They've got movie adaptations. They sold. There's also the whole correlation is not causation. Wortham and the code did not kill comics. Period. End of statement. It's been proven time and time and time and time again. Distribution and profit killed comics. In 1955-56, Leader News, which distributed EC as well as a number of other comic companies, went bankrupt. William Gaines, in his interviews, talked about how in 55 they got rid of the horror and crime line because they knew it wouldn't go through the code. They were going to submit to the code, but they knew these books weren't going to make it through the code. And also, they were running out of ideas. They were trying to hire new writers. They weren't getting the stuff they liked. Mad had started as a magazine and was making tons of money. So he started the New Direction, which was comics like Impact, Piracy, Psychoanalysis, MD. Now, first off, those weren't things that kids were interested in. And second, Leader News was going under, so he would ship these out to the distributor. The distributor wouldn't have money, so they'd just return them. They'd just return the bundles. They wouldn't even open the bundles. And Gaines talks about how he'd send out the books, they would come back, the distributors wouldn't have even opened the bundles to send them out to stores. It's because they didn't have the money. They wanted to distribute stuff that made money. Your profit on a 10-cent comic was 2 cents. Your profit on Confidential Magazine, which was 50 cents, was 10 cents. And they take up about the same amount of shelf space. Pulp magazines, which sold for a quarter, were being displaced by Slick magazines, which sold for 50 cents. Double the profit, same space. Leader News goes under. What few comic companies could went over to American News. American News Distribution. Now, American News Distribution, comics weren't selling that well. They had Dell. When you have Dell, you don't need much else.
Have Dell, you're feeling swell.
Martin Goodman, who was distributing his stuff under the Atlas Distribution. That's why the Marvel or Timely comics of the 50s have the Atlas symbol. The comic was not named Atlas. It was still Timely Comics, but Atlas was the distribution. It also distributed as men magazines like Stag, Swank, what they called the men's sweat magazines, because it would be girls in various stages of undress and stories of men doing manly things at war or going to Africa and beating up lions. What was the paperback line? I think the paperback line was actually called Lion Books. Those sold. Then, in 1957, American News went bankrupt. That's when Atlas had to scramble. The Atlas logo came off the comics in like 55, 56. They were going through American News, and that's when they had to go to independent distribution, which was owned by the same company that owned DC Comics. And they were cut down to only 8 per month. Meanwhile, Mad Magazine, if you look on the covers like there, you'll see the IND hidden in the logo, and that's independent distribution. Kind of like how Playboy back in the 50s and 60s and 70s had stars on the cover. The star was which sub-distributor was getting it from independent distribution. And this myth that just keeps going on, that the Code killed comics and Wortham killed comics, the price killed comics, distribution killed comics. And it wasn't until the mid-60s that Marvel was selling well enough that they were able to secure distribution with another company. Once they got the distribution with another company and could publish as many books as they want, Martin Goodman started working on selling. And eventually, I think it was either 71 or 72, he sold Marvel to Candace Industries.
Yep. Because that's when I started. I always figured whoever bought Marvel got the best friggin' deal of a lifetime. Even though Ron Perlman couldn't run it to save his soul, he did make a couple billion off it.
Well, the thing to remember, too, is by the mid-70s, Marvel was bleeding money. They were still number one in sales, but everything was late because they didn't have Stan in charge. Stan was a great office manager who made sure.
The direct market hadn't really been born yet. It was starting to kick and scream, but it wasn't really in its – it hadn't saved anything yet. It, by the time – it was Dazzler One was, I think, the olive branch, more like a feeler out to this direct market that had become more important. And then that's pretty much what probably saved a lot of these bad boys, because the newsstand was just disappearing.
And by the time the direct market got geared up, Dell had gotten out of comic publishing, and they pretty much did magazines, books, and puzzle books. Believe it or not, Dell is still around. Next time you're at the grocery store, you see all those puzzle magazines? You'll see some of them are Dell, and some of them are Penny Press. They're the same company. So Dell is still around. They just quit printing and distributing comics. And Gold Key, which was the company that packaged their comics, started printing and distributing themselves. And by the end of the 70s, they were dead. They had gone from being the 800-pound gorilla in the 50s and 60s, too, by the end of the 70s, they were gone. Harvey, pretty much by the end of the 70s, they were gone. And in the mid-70s, Harvey was making money hand over fist. But even Frank Miller,
there's a
and all these people.
On eBay. Well, I was just going to mention, I added you to a group. I don't know if you stayed there. It's called Dell and Gold Key Comics, and basically it's just guys sharing their comics on Facebook, that ones they have found, not only the comics but also like the Golden Age books, if you're well, like here I'm looking, here's a 15 cent Walt Disney Zorro photo cover, you know, there's a couple I've had, Rocky and Bullwinkle Gold Key. Somebody put up the I Dream of Jeannie with Larry Hagman, very topical since he passed away. But there were a whole series like Flip It cartoon books, if you remember those little ones where you you know, things like that. All this was done by Gold Key or Dell. And I added you to the Facebook page, Corey. I don't know if you wanted to stay there or not. But it's really kind of fun. Again, it's called Dell and Gold Key Comics. They just share it. If people have information about the comics, they'll put it on there. And it's always kind of fun just to see what comics comes up next. And I'm looking forward just to get home just to see what I have. Because some of these I'm like, I remember having this, but did I sell it when I sold off all my photo covers long time ago or not? And sometimes you run across one you've never heard of, like the Close Shaves of Pauline Pearl. Looks like some ditzy blonde redhead, green-headed leaf teenage girl. And then occasionally you run into ones that, what I do, they, like the, remember, Hanna-Barbera's Wacky Races?
Yes.
See, some people don't. And when I describe it to them, they look at me like I'm high. Well, they have, apparently there was a comic book or two with them that had them, and you can put them up and say, hey, see, here's what I was talking about. Lidsville, that was a Gold Key comic. So, but you see, folks, now you understand why Corey's got this burning knowledge in him that he's got to get out before he implodes. He probably knows more about comics and things like what he's just been talking about than most people do. And I'm looking forward to actually sitting back and listening to him talk with people who know about as much as he does with comics, or even just historical things on your own, you know? Besides, you give me the weekend free.
Well, believe it or not, kids, actually, Joe, just because I know we'll have a couple listeners who email, what do you mean we're not going to get as much crazy? No, you'll still get your crazy. And we're not going to change the format of this all that much. We're actually 9-10 episodes away from episode 100.
Boy, and we already have it planned out, unlike most of the time. Oh, that was a little bit behind the scenes we shouldn't have talked about.
Well, it's going to be an all clips episode, like the episodes of Happy Days where you could tell that they didn't want to pay the actors. So they just had them go, you remember that one time back when Dad bought the new car? And then they'd show a clip of that. And then the next person would say, yeah, that was a great time. Do you remember that time when I dated the girl from across town? That way we could just, you know, do that. And then, you know, nothing but clips.
I can't be.
But believe it or not, kids, you've wasted an hour and a half of your life listening to us go blather on and on about funny books. And you heard me get really passionate about the fact that, no! Quit getting it wrong!
Yep. I think I doubt. And now I'm going to do something that I have never done. There, I'm opening up my Hot Wheel. I have just freed the Martian rover. Boing. Point. I think I'm set for the next hour.
Well, there you go.
Oh, look, the little camera spins around. And I broke it.
That's why you leave it in the box.
Oh, well, I got the Batmobile I can open.
Well, just a reminder, everybody, that the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic you like the most. Joe?
I am so awesome. Somebody hit my music.
Funk is on a roll. Funk is on a roll.
Hey, yo.
Funk.